All right, so I'm not going to do the Navi shir today, but I'm going to do this shir a little bit extended, probably. This is probably also going to be a two-part, because even if I went straight till 11, I don't think I could really cover everything. The topic of the shir is we're in Sefer Shmos. So it's really very connected to Sefer Shmos, but we're not going to get to the connection tonight. Tonight, really, we're going to talk more about Tu Bishvat, which is upcoming. And the connection to Sefer Shmos will have to come next week, Be'ezus Hashem. So it's not going to, I don't think we're going to get to a connection to the Parsha directly today. So if you were counting on this year to have something to say over at the table, I don't know if I can deliver that tonight. But I do have a handout, so we can start with that. Here, I think that's well, yeah. No, it's the same. Just two sides of the same page. I'll give one to you. There you go. Oh, well, I'm going to read it and translate it very carefully. I'm sorry. Okay. So this week, was it yesterday? It seems like so long ago already. But yesterday was Rosh Chodesh Shvat. So the reason why this is connected to Shmos, we can start off by saying it's connected to all the Torah is connected, but particularly the reason why it's connected to Shmos is that at this time of the year we have a concept of what's called Shovavim. Shovavim comes from the Rashi Tevos, the first letters of the Parshios of Shmos, Va'era, Bo, Bishalach, Yisro Mishpatim, Shovavim. And there's traditionally this is a time period of renewed growth and renewed kind of a renewed effort in Avodas Hashem, connecting to various aspects of the Torah. There are many shiurim that are given during Shovim, extra shiurim in halacha and other types of things to try to use this time period, since it's the winter time and it's a time that doesn't really have any chagim. So it's a time of trying to kind of renew our avodas Hashem, renew our dveikus, renew our attempts to connect to Hashem and to be ovdei Hashem and to serve Him properly.
What's the source of this?
Source of it, I believe, is in the Arizal, in the writings of the Arizal. Although I'm sure that it has earlier sources as well, but I believe that the name Shovavim comes from the Arizal. It's one of those interesting things that exists in Yiddishkeit that has become very much in vogue over the last, I guess, maybe 10 years. I know that when I was growing up in yeshiva, I never heard of it at all. I only heard of it as an adult. So nowadays it's become much more common to hear discussion about it. So if the parshios of Shovavim, of Shmos, Va'era, Bo, Bishalach, Yisro, Mishpatim, come out pretty much in Chodesh Shvat, pretty much right around Chodesh Shvat. And Chodesh Shvat has this particular chag in it of Tu Bishvat. So it would make sense to say that there is a connection between the two. We know that every week, right, the parsha of the week has a connection to the time that we find ourselves in, not only in terms of, you know, the year and place we find ourselves in, but in terms of the zman, in terms of the time period, the cycle of the year. So the parshios that happen during the time period of Shovavim clearly have to have a connection to the to Shovavim and to that time period and to the time period of Shvat and Tu Bishvat. So that's really where we're heading, but it's going to take a while to develop how that connection works. This is based on the Torah that I'm going to say over is based on the Torah of a number of people that I've mentioned in the past, Rav Kirzner Zatzal, my own Rebbe, Rav Shlomo Freifeld Zatzal, and There's a Torah, a very beautiful Torah that's given by the Bnei Yisachar, which we're going to see partly inside and partly outside. That I was alerted to by a young Talmud Chacham, Rav Eitan Feiner, who was a Rebbe in Eshet Torah last year. This year, I think he's in the Five Towns. Very wonderful Talmud Chacham, as well as other Rabbeim of mine We'll start by saying like this. Let's look at the Mishnah, because that's where it comes from. It all starts with the Mishnah. The Mishnah says here, on Arba Rosh Hashanim Haim. We have a handout here, if you like one. So Arba Rosh Hashanim Haim. There are four Rosh Hashanahs. Be'echad B'Nisan Rosh Hashanah L'Melachim V'Regalin. And the first of Nisan is the Rosh Hashanah for kings and for Yamim Tovim. Right? If you want to know what year of the reign of a particular king of Klal Yisrael is, so if the king was coronated in Adar, so then after the first of Nisan, that's already considered the second year of his reign, because that's considered the Rosh Hashanah. It doesn't matter when during the year, and as well for the Yom Tovim, we always count the Yom Tovim starting from Pesach, Shavuot, Sukkot. We never count it in any other way. Pesach is considered the first of the Shalosh Regalim. Be'echad Be'elul Rosh Hashanah L'Maaseh Behema, right? When Jewish person has a farm with livestock, so the firstborn of the livestock has to be given as Maaseh Behema. How do you know when what year to bring that Maaseh Behema in? In other words, it's like every year the firstborn of that year have to be brought. Maaseh, I'm sorry, right, one out of ten, right, correct, one out of ten. Correct, but there's a livestock, the livestock of that year, you have to bring one out of ten, so how do you know when to count the year? So if you have the livestock as of the first of Elul, or according to Rabbi Elazar of Shimon, Echad B'Tishrei, the first of Tishrei, then that becomes the Maaseh that you have to give of that year, that's correct. Echad B'Tishrei, Shana L'Shanim, V'L'Shmitin, V'L'Yovlos, V'L'Netia, V'L'Yarakos, right? So the first of Tishrei is Rosh Hashanah for years, for Shemitahs, for Yovels, for planting, and for vegetables, right? For like planting of vegetables and regular kind of produce. V'Echad B'Shvat, the first of Shvat, Rosh Hashanah Le'ilan, that's Rosh Hashanah for the tree. K'divrei Beis Shammai, that's what Beis Shammai says. Beis Hillel Omrim B'Chamisha Asar B'Chamisha, Beis Hillel says on the 15th of Shvat, that's where we get Tes Vav, is the Hebrew way of counting the number 15. That's where we get the name Tu B'Shvat from the opinion of Beis Hillel. We paskin like Beis Hillel in general. There are only a few places in the Talmud that we don't paskin like Beis Hillel. So we paskin like Beis Hillel as always here. Therefore, we observe the 15th of Shvat as Tu B'Shvat.
According to Elazar and Rabbi Shimon, there are only three Rosh Hashanahs.
No.
They say it's a tissue.
Correct.
They got tissue.
Right. Correct. That's a good observation. The Gemara points that out as well. As a matter of fact, let's see right away. Let's do this text right away so we can see where we stand. If you'll read with me, the next text says Masnisan. It points out a number of things in the. This is from the Bnei Yisachar. Masnisan be'echad b'shvat Rosh Hashanah le'ilan k'divrei Beis Shammai Beis Hillel omrim b'tubo. That's just quoting the Mishnah. Ad kan. Hine omru kedivrei Beis Shammai b'chaf. So he points out that Beis Shammai, it says kedivrei Beis Shammai. If you look at the last line of the Mishnah, it says be'echad b'shvat, in the first of Shvat, Rosh Hashanah le'ilan, kedivrei Beis Shammai. So that's a very strange way of putting it. The Mishnah never says kedivrei Beis Shammai. The Mishnah will say Beis Shammai Omer, or we'll just say the statement that he says, and I'll say Divrei Beis Shammai. I'll never say Kid Divrei Beis Shammai. I know that sounds a little bit like nitpicking, right? Because so it says Divrei, Kid Divrei. But that is the way that the Mishnah was written. The Mishnah was written very concisely by Rabbi Yehuda Anasi. He edited the Mishnayos together, and he paid very, very careful attention to the details, and we can derive things as is true even in the Gemara, but less so in the Gemara and more so in the Mishnah, even more so, of course, in the Torah itself. The additional letter, a prefix where it's unexpected, usually signifies something. Something is hidden here that we need to mine to find out what's going on. So he's pointing out that immediately, if you're a student of the Talmud and you know Mishnayos, you'll know that this is, I believe, the only occasion when the opinion of Beis Shammai is delivered as Kid Divrei Beis Shammai. If every other place in the Mishnah it says Divrei Beis Shammai or Beis Shammai Omer, so, and suddenly here it says Kid Divrei Beis Shammai, that's a clear sign that there's something here to be found. Al Pia Pshat Yishlomer. So first he says, well, let's say a regular Pshat. The Hinei Begemara, and the Gemara later on in this Masech, this is Maseches Rosh Hashanah, and Zayin Amad Aleph, Heviu Brisos, the Gemara brings Brisos. Brisos are those teachings of the Tanaim, who were the authors of the Mishnah, those teachings that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi edited out of the final version of the Mishnayos. So they existed at the same time as the Mishnayos, but for whatever reason, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi decided that they weren't going to be part of the major body of Mishnayos. So he didn't throw them out. They kind of got collected in on their own as, like, you know, that which was taken out. It's called Brisos. And Brisos also are important in the study of the Mishnah because very often, right, we don't usually get the chance to do this, but if you would look at an author and look at their final book, let's say, even a secular author writes a book, and you look at the book, you read the book, wow, it's a masterpiece. But very often you can really tell more about the intent of the author by, if you got to see their notes and see what they edited out, you would see what they were really driving at. But in order to make the book work, so they have to edit certain things out to make it flow, whatever, but you'd get a much bigger picture. So really, that's true in when we have the opportunity to do this, right, in Mishnayos as well. You can see a lot about the Mishnayos from the Brisos because you can see what Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi decided to leave out. And the things that he left out are no less potent in terms of being part of the Masorah. They were also taught by the same Tanaim. They were also taught as teachings that they had received from their Rebbeim. So they also have validity as halacha. He can't deny, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, by editing them out, is not saying that therefore they're to be ignored in terms of the part being part of the Masorah. But what he's saying is they're not normative in the sense that they're not going to become part of the corpus of direct halachic application the way we live Torah, and therefore they're like in a different category. And it's very, very fascinating. And the Gemara, a lot of Gemara, when Gemara is analyzing the Mishnah, very often they'll bring Brisos as questions. Like the Mishnah says this, but what about the Brisa that says this? So why doesn't the Mishnah agree? Meaning, why did Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi leave that out on the side? And we'll learn something from the fact that it's not included. So he says the Gemara here brings Brisos. The Yesh Od Kama Rosh Hashanah. The Brisos say that there are other Rosh Hashanah. There are a number of other Rosh Hashanahs as well. Tezayin ben Nisan, right? The 16th of Nisan is the Rosh Hashanah for the Omer. For the Omer here doesn't mean the counting of the Omer. It means the bringing of the Karban of the Omer, right? V'chag HaShavuos, Rosh Hashanah l'shtei alechem. And the day of the Shavuos is also the Rosh Hashanah for the two breads that were brought also as part of a karban that was brought on, and this has to do with chadash, this has to do with the cycle of grains and when you can eat it, the new grain, the grain of the old year. We're not going to get into the details of that, but these are all things that you are required to know when a year begins and when a year ends. Just like by Meiser, by the way, why is it important to know when the beginning and end of a year of a tree is also the very practical halacha that comes out of it, because a tree, when you plant the tree, you have to wait till the fourth year until you can eat the fruit. And the fourth year, you bring the fruit up to Yerushalayim as part of like a meiser, in a sense, right? And you bring it as, and then once you bring it up to Yerushalayim, then the next year you can eat the fruit. So you have to know, I mean, you're not going to always plant trees on the same date every year. So you have to know what year constitutes the first year. So anything that's planted before the Rosh Hashanah Le'ilan, right, before Tu Bishvat is going to be the last year, and anything from Rosh Hashanah is going to be the next year. So same thing over here, when you bring the Shtei Alechem, having to do with when you can eat the old Tevua, when you can eat the new Tevua, when you can do Chadash, and so on. You have to know when the year begins. So these are also Rosh Hashanahs. Umetaret Sham. So the Gemara there is asking from the Baisa, why does the Mishnah start by saying Arba'a Rosh Hashanim Haim, that there are four Rosh Hashanahs? I'll show you from these Brisos that Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi is being very clever here. He's saying there's only four Rosh Hashanahs and he's listing them, but that's because he's editing out all these other Rosh Hashanahs. So what's going on here? Why does he say there's only four? So in Mitaret Sham Kamiti, Rutsam, the Gemara explains several answers. Masha Tana Didan Lo Kachashiv. that the number of answers that our Tana, the Tana of our Mishnah, the main teacher of our Mishnah, did not consider them to be Rosh Hashanahs for whatever reasons. Ulachat Terutz, and according to one of the answers that the Gemara brings, that is that the Tana didan lo kachashiv rak arba Rosh Hashanim shehin barashay chadashim. Our Tana of our Mishnah only felt that a Rosh Hashanah has to take place on Rosh Chodesh. If there's a Rosh Hashanah that doesn't take place on Rosh Chodesh, he doesn't consider that to be a complete Rosh Hashanah. Why would that be? Let's think about why that might be from a practical, just a logical level. So the answer is that Rosh Chodesh is already a Rosh. The idea of Rosh Chodesh is a time of renewal. It's already kind of built into the time period of the year that there's the big Rosh Hashanah that we have on Rosh Chodesh Tishrei. But every other Rosh Chodesh is also, in a sense, a renewal. So if there's going to be a Rosh Hashanah, it's going to be at a time that's particularly set aside for renewal, the 11 smaller times of renewal. So that he's going to consider like a Rosh Hashanah that's worth speaking about. The other Rosh Hashanahs, even though it could be true that that's how you count the year, it's not necessarily coming at a time of renewal. It's not necessarily coming at a time when there's like in the world the spirit of kind of renewal there. So therefore, even though we count it there, but it's not so deep. It's not like something that's, this is my explanation. This is not what the Gemara says. But my understanding of it is that that's just a way of delineating which year it is. But when it actually falls on a Rosh Chodesh, that tells you that there's something deeper here, that there's something in the time period itself that has to do with Hischadshus, that has to do with renewal. So we're going to see, right, exactly. So Makashi, Echad, B'Shvat, Kibbeh Shammai. And so they say, and you see, Makashi, Echad, B'Shvat, Kibbeh Shammai, Mitaritz. So what about the fact that B'Shvat Shammai says that an Echad, B'Shvat, meaning, and the problem is that Beis Hillel says, Chamisha Asar, the 15th. So therefore, according to Beis Hillel, how many Rosh Chodeshes are there going to be? Meaning, the Tana of our Mishnah says there are four Rosh Hashanahs. Why? Because there are four that fall out on Rosh Chodesh. But Beis Hillel says that it comes out on Tu B'Shvat, like you remember, right? So that makes it only three. So that's a problem. So if maybe he should have just left off the opinion of Beis Hillel altogether. Tari Stachi Kamar, he explains that this is what he means. Gimel the Divrei HaKol, there are three according to everybody. Varavi plukta the Beis Shammai Beis Hillel, and the fourth one is an argument between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, since at least it's an argument that maybe it should be on Rosh Chodesh, he's going to include it. Uflize hu bediktuk nachon, therefore it's okay for him to include it. Maschil hatana arba Rosh Hashanim heim, he's able to start off by saying arba Rosh Hashanim heim, there are four Rosh Hashanahs, be arba Rosh Chodashim, on four Rosh Chodeshes. Umona osan achas l'achas, and he counts them one by one. Ad shemagia el echad b'shvat, until he comes to the first of Shvat, where he says is kid divrei Beis Shammai. Now he's explaining the Gemara. He's explaining why it is that it's kid, because if the Tana of our Mishnah is coming to tell us only about Rosh Hashanahs, since there are four, it's only Rosh Hashanahs that start out on Rosh Chodesh. So when he says Beis Shammai, now he's saying the fourth Rosh Hashanah that falls out on Rosh Chodesh, which is like what he says. So if he says kid divrei Beis Shammai, right? And Zehu, that's it. Rak, Aliba, Zehu, Rak, Aliba, Beis Shammai. Masha Enken, Beis Hillel. However, according to Beis Hillel, Einon El Rak, Shlosha, Rosh Hashanim, Rosh Chodeshim, there are only three that fall on Rosh Chodesh. Behuna, Chon, Api, Apshat, Api, Atir, Tzab, Gemar, and so on. So again, what he's saying is that the Gemara is saying, Pashat, Pshat, why does it say Kid Divrei Beis Shammai? Because there's an underlying thing happening here in the Mishnah. The Tana of our Mishnah knows that there are other opinions of other Rosh Hashanahs, but he's saying dafka that there are four, and the reason why he's saying that there are dafka four is because there are only four that are on Rosh Chodesh. He lists them in order. Even the argument that we had before was based on it was the question of Echad B'Tishrei or Echad Be'elul, it was still on a Rosh Chodesh. Till he gets to Beis Shammai and he says Be'echad B'Shvat Rosh Hashanah Le'ilan Kedivrei Beis Shammai. According to Beis Shammai, meaning, and now I've shown you the four Rosh Hashanahs that fall out on the four Rosh Chodeshes. And then he answers, oh no, Beis Hillel disagrees. Beis Hillel says, Chamisha as well, that's not good. That's going back on the Arba Rosh Hashanah name. There's Arba Rosh Hashanah, according to everything I count, and according to Divrei Beis Shammai. But according to Beis Hillel, there's only going to be three. So that's a simple, I don't know how simple it is, but that's a simple pshat of the Gemara to explain this. The Gemara doesn't use it to explain the... This is the Bnei Yisachar. This is, according to the discussion in the Gemara about the number four, that there are four Rosh Hashanahs. Bnei Yisachar was from Dinov. His name was, I have his name written down in my notes, actually. Yeah, we pronounce it as Bnei Yisachar. That's why that is, I don't know. But that's the Bnei Yisachar. Rav Tzvi Elimelech Shapiro Midinov. So the Bnei Yisachar, using that discussion in the Gemara, he's adding on a dimension and saying that once you know that discussion in the Gemara, you can then explain why there's this different language of Kid Divrei Beis Shammai in the Mishnah that fits in well with that answer in the Gemara that explains why the other Rosh Hashanahs aren't counted, and that's the simple pshat. However, as always, there are many levels to this, and we'd like to look at a deeper level. On a deeper level, we can say, what is... I mean, there's so many ways to go. We're going to just pick one and go with it for a while, and we'll have to switch tracks a few times. But on a deeper level, the idea is that there's something happening on Tu B'Shvat that is a renewal of the trees, right? Aside from the practical halacha of the fact that you have to know when to count the year of the trees in order to know when the fourth year of the tree's fruits is, but there's a deeper thing happening in the tree. We're not even talking about anything more than the trees. In the trees, there's a certain growth that happens, because if you look at the season in Eretz Yisrael, you'll know the rainy season starts on Sukkot, right, around Sukkot time, and therefore this year it hasn't been that way. I was just there and everyone was davening for rain tremendously because there hasn't been enough rain, but generally speaking, in a good healthy year when there's enough rains, the rains start on Sukkot and they continue on and on and on, and sometimes it seems like they'll never end, and by the time you get to Shvat, so we're starting to see the end. The end is in sight, right? We've already been through a few months of the rain, and now by the time Nisan comes, which is only now 2 months away, it's going to end. So there's been enough water that there's a real growth process that could happen in the planting of trees, and so we're in a certain sense celebrating, like, you know, you could. When we talk about trees that you plant, it's one thing, but even if we talk about trees that just happen, right? Like a tree has, the niflos abore, the way trees reproduce, so they drop their leaves, and every tree has like a different scheme, like how their seeds are going to be able to be planted, right? So, you know, I don't remember which tree it is that has those... like little wings that make it fly. Is that a maple tree? Yeah, that the seeds fly so that they don't fall right in the shadow of the tree. Like, amazing things. There was an article once about a tree that has a fruit that comes out of the tree that's unbelievably delicious. And for some reason, the seeds, however, are like extremely, extremely bitter. So what inevitably happens is an animal will take the fruit and will eat it, but it's very chewy, so it'll be chewing it, and then when it gets to the seeds, and it's bitter, it'll spit them out, but by that time, it's nowhere near the tree, right? But I don't know, are they that bitter? I don't know. But in any case, so they were saying, like, the whole thing was like a, you know, so they were saying it from a secular perspective, but from a perspective of Kadosh Baruch Hu created a tree, that tree should have a system that should be able to reproduce in a healthy way. So there's not every tree, not every seed that comes from a tree takes root, but the ones that will take root this year will have been in the ground and have received enough water to take root and to start sprouting by the time that Shvat comes around. So, on a simple way of looking at it, this is not so simple, but still simpler than we're going to get. So, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel are coming from different worlds, right? The reason we know that the Chazal tell us that in the Yemos HaMashiach, where everything's going to be, the halacha is going to be according to Beis Shammai. It's only now in this world that before Mashiach that Allah is like Beis Hillel. And Beis Hillel is always the one who seems to be Mekel. He seems to be like the more lenient opinion in most cases. And Beis Shammai seems to be the more strict opinion. So that sometimes gets scary. I think sometimes feel like we shouldn't tell people too much that Allah is going to be like Beis Shammai when Mashiach comes, because then people are not going to want Mashiach, right? Because Beis Shammai's laws are sometimes difficult to live by. Like, for example... right, like the classic one is Hillel says Ketzad Marakim Lefnei Akala. How do you dance in front of a Kala? You say Kala Navachasuda, right? That she's beautiful and she's very amazing, right? That's how you dance in front of a kala. And Beis Shammai says, kala kamos shahi. You tell her like it is, right? So if you hear that, you think like, who wants to live in the days of Mashiach? They're going to be at a chasana and somebody's saying, ah, you're so plain looking, right? Right? Like it's not going to. It doesn't sound like a world we want to live in. So obviously, it's much deeper than that. It's much deeper than that because it goes to on one level, it just goes to the idea that in the time of the Yemos HaMashiach, there's not going to be a need for people to judge themselves based on externalities. In other words, there's not going to be. It's not that in Yemos HaMashiach you're going to dance in front of a kala and you're going to tell her like the way she looks. In the Yemos HaMashiach, we're going to be able to see the kala kamos shehi as she really is. Right, which is not about her looks. It's not about the way she's dressed or how her hair was done. That's nothing to do with that. That's not who she is at all. Right, we're going to see kamos shehi. That's what Beis Shammai means. We're going to be living on a level where we're going to be able to perceive reality the way it really is, not in the way it is to us today, which is so confused by externalities. So Beis Hillel, when it comes across as being more lenient, really it's because Beis Hillel is being more consistent with the way we see the world, which is with all these filters and confusion. And so in a world of filters and confusion, we sometimes have to work with that in order to be connect to Hashem, because we can't pretend that they're not there. That's what we're feeling. That's what we're experiencing. Can't deny your experiences. You have to work with them to eventually get beyond them. But Beis Shammai is talking about a world where he sees things. Chas v'shalom, Beis Shammai doesn't mean you dance in front of a kala and make her feel bad. It means you dance in front of a kala and you really see her inner beauty and who she really is, and the externalities just play no role whatsoever. It's not even anything to talk about. So that's why Beis Shammai comes across as being more harif, more sharp, and so on. But it's because he's going straight to the world, really, of emes. The world of emes is also, in that sense, in this sense, can be a world of din. A world of din is a world of judgment in the sense of realities, of what's really true and what's really false, what's really right and what's really wrong, right? And Beis Hillel is really in more of the world of rachamim, in the world of chesed, where there's judgments that are made, right? Like ultimately, if you pass by somebody in the street, he's asking for money. So in the world of rachamim, so you give him the money. In the world of din, it would be a clear cut. Either the person really needs the money and is really deserving of it, or not. Right, but we don't live in that world. And most of the time, somebody comes to our door, or we see somebody in the street, they're asking for money. We don't really know what's going on, but we know that they're asking us. And if they're asking us, we assume therefore there's a real need, so we give them the money. Right, in the world of din, there's no room for that, because they wouldn't be asking if they didn't really need it, and we would know immediately if they really needed it or not. That's the world of din. That's the world of Mashiach. So it's not a bad place at all. It's actually a very beautiful place, a place of real reality. So when Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel are now arguing about the Rosh Hashanah for the trees, so what they're really arguing about is, in a sense, Beis Shammai is saying, let's deal with reality as it is. The reality is that by Rosh Chodesh Shvat, that seed has already taken root and is already sprouting. You can't see it because it hasn't necessarily come out of the ground. It hasn't necessarily pushed its way out of the ground. But that doesn't matter. We know that it's there already, right? It takes whatever seeds will have taken root. By the time Rosh Chodesh Shvat comes along, it's already taken root, and it's only a matter of days or a couple of weeks or whatever it is until it actually pushes its way through the ground. But we know it's already there, so we can celebrate the Rosh Hashanah for the trees on Rosh Chodesh Shvat, because that's the world of reality as things really are. But Beis Hillel is living in the world of illusion, in a sense, right, where we can't, he holds that we can't paskin, we can't go halachically according to the reality of what is. We have to go with what we perceive. We have to go with the way we see things to actually be, and we don't see the leaves poking through. We don't see the sapling poking through the ground until a little bit later. It takes another couple of weeks. So therefore, Beis Hillel says, no, wait until Tu B'Shvat. Then in a very low level is really the it's the first step of the depth of their argument, and of course, if we say that the days of the Shovavim are the days that we're supposed to be kind of giving expression more to our Avodas Hashem, so we can see it doesn't matter whether you hold it as Rosh Chodesh Shvat or Tu B'Shvat, but we can see already a little bit of a consistency, the idea that we're supposed to be pushing through, right, in a certain sense, on Rosh Hashanah or around the whole Yom Tovim, which lasted through Sukkot, through the end of Sukkot, through Shemini Atzeres, we kind of take in It's a time of renewal, a time of renewed commitment, a time of growth. Nobody goes through Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Aseres Yemei Tshuva process without coming coming out with the commitments and, you know, whether they're New Year's resolutions or whatever term you'll use to describe them. Everybody comes out of that time period with a renewed sense of wanting to do what's right in the world and wanting to grow and so on. So now we've been through a few months where we should have been able to allow those seeds that were planted around that time to come into expression. So around this time, around the time of Shavuot, we want to make sure that they come into expression. So therefore, we take this time period of and concentrate on talking about specific things, specific ways of growing, specific mitzvos, and we have a lot of extra shiurim and so on in order to try to help that sprout, help it actually come out of the ground, help it come into reality. But there's, of course, a lot more going on here as well. So let's start by looking at the other side of your handout. This is a passage, I've never really given out as a source from the Sefer Yetzirah before, so we're not going to go into it in the depth, but the Sefer Yetzirah is one of the oldest texts that we have. The Sefer Yetzirah is attributed to Avraham Avinu. So, in the Sefer Yetzirah, in the fifth parak, you go through a number of different things. Right. So whether it's actually the exact words or whether it went through, we don't know. We don't know exactly. We certainly don't have any copies that were written by Avraham Avinu. And very often with these things, what we will find is that the ideas came from, for example, we spoke about this in the Navi Shir when we were talking about Aleinu. And how Yahushua wrote Aleinu, but there's a Gemara that says that it was written by someone else. I forgot the Gemara already. That there was, or part of it was written by someone else. And we said that there was a connection. No, you don't remember? Okay, so I don't feel so bad for not remembering either. But we saw there was a connection. And the idea was that when a sefer is attributed to certain people, it's because there's a certain connection. That's you're talking about the Zohar.
No, that his legs were cut off.
Oh, well, no.
That's the
Nisan Tokev. No, that's a different story. No. But Aleinu was written by Yoshua, but there is a certain indication somewhere that says it was written by someone else. And then we saw, I think in the context of, I don't know if we actually spoke it out, but there's certain kapitlach of Tehillim, certain chapters of Tehillim that are attributed to sources earlier than David HaMelech, even though David HaMelech was the one who actually wrote them down, like Mizmor Shel Yom HaShabbos, I think this was Moshe Rabbeinu, and so on. So what does it mean Moshe wrote it down? We know that David wrote it in Sefer Tehillim, so it means that Moshe wrote it, and then David rewrote it, whatever it means. Right, there's certain Tehillim, Talmud Rishon also, exactly. So whatever it means, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's word for word exactly, like we have a copy that we can pull out and say, oh, this is authored by Avraham Avinu. But it means that the ideas came from Avinu, maybe a lot of the language, maybe not necessarily all of the language, it could have been added to and so on. But basically, it's attributed to Avraham Avinu. All the Sfarim assume that it is tremendous, tremendous Kedusha. And a lot of Kabbalah has its roots in Sefer Yetzirah. So the Sefer Yetzirah, we're really not, I'm not qualified to really teach a Shir in Sefer Yetzirah. So I just gave you a copy of just to show you in the writing what's happening over here. The first thing he says, talk about there's 12 letters that are called Osios Pshutos. And I'm not going into that at all right now because I only know a little bit of what that's about and I need to do more research and I'd like to go into that at one point. But he says there are basically these 12 osios. And then these 12 osios are paralleled by 12 mazalos, 12, how we translate it into English, 12...
constellations.
Yeah, but constellations in the sense of... Yeah, I don't want to use the word zodiac, but in the sense of, signs. Let's say signs, right, astrological signs. And then he names what they are, Tala, Ashar, Ta'umim, all these different things. And the 11th one is Dili, right, which is a bucket. Adar, of course, which is the last one. The 10th one is Dili. The 11th one is Dagim, which is fish, right? And Nisan is the first, right? So the 12th is Adar.
The 12th is Adar, and the 11th is Dili.
Sorry, correct. You're right. Sorry. I was right the first time. Dali is the 11th, correct. Shabbat, the 11th month. Dagim is the 12th month, which is fish, which is Adar. Ve'eloheim, Yudbeis Chadashim Bashanah, he names the 12 months, Shabbat being the 11th, and then Adar. Ve'eloheim, Shnei Masar Manhigim Banefesh. Therefore, he says, these also parallel the 12 limbs, in a sense, 12 parts of the human being that guide the somehow related to the nefesh of a person, to the spirituality of a person. Those are shtei adayim, two hands; shtei raglayim, two feet, two legs; shtei kalayos, two shoulders; kaved kalayos, the kidneys. Correct. What did I say? Oh, shoulders, two kidneys. Sorry. Kaved is the liver. Mara is, I'm not sure. Is it gallbladder? Okay. Yeah, probably gallbladder. Hamisas, I don't know. Kiba is, I'm not sure, but Kirkavan is like the stomach. I think it's the well, in Gemara language, it's the stomach. Yeah, there's a lot of. Yeah. Well, I think Kirkavan, according to the Gemara language, is like the stomach, and that's the one that's important for us now. Right, exactly. Right. So that's the halachic language. Korkum is the stomach area. So basically what we have here is a parallel between the Dali, which is the bucket, and the 11th month, which is Shvat.
Tachol
is the spleen. So what is...
The spleen is the stomach.
Stomach, yes. So and the Korkum, which is the stomach. So now we have to start trying to establish some sort of a connection between a bucket, the month of Shvat, the stomach, and the Shovavim, right? The Parshios of Shmos Ve'era Bo B'Shalach Yisro Mishpatim, and the time period of the year, and everything that we've said until now.
What is Dali?
Dali is a bucket. Right. So, what is special about a bucket? And here, many of you may have heard of these before, so it's a little bit of chazar, but it's still beautiful ideas worth hearing again. So a bucket is not only, before we talk about what it is, there's a chiddush here, there's something different about this sign than all the other signs. The Gemara says in a certain place that Klal Yisrael, the Jewish people, live outside of mazalos. They live outside of mazal. That they're beyond mazal. And this, what that means is that we're not restricted by a mazal. Mazal is a certain type of, emanation of a person's, right? There is some sort of, I don't think it's what you read in the paper in the horoscope column, right? But there is some sort of genuine idea that there are these hashpaos, these emanations or these influences that appear in the world at different times. I mean, we believe that simply, our whole discussion about Tu B'Shvat and the time period that we're in and the fact that there's something going on in this time period is only important if it's going to have something real to tell us about our lives today. To just talk about Tu B'Shvat as some sort of a thing that happens up in the air and doesn't have any meaning in our real lives, it'd be a nice exercise, but it wouldn't be all that valuable. But the idea is that all the Yom Tovim, all the things that happen in the cycle of the Jewish year, have direct relevance to that time period, and there are certain emanations that exist in time that we can tap into if we're sensitive to it, if we open ourselves to it. So the idea that in different times of the year there are different signs, and those signs that represent these different emanations, these different kochos, these different powers, in a sense, so that a person born under that time will have certain powers or certain, you know, leanings or certain influences in their life, whatever it is, it comes out in a certain way and has some sort of meaning. But and those things don't have absolute control, but they kind of nudge. And that's why sometimes you'll read somebody, every once in a while, I'll meet somebody who knows a lot about the zodiac and a lot about the astrological signs, and they'll talk to me for a little while, and they'll say, you must be a Sagittarius. And I'll say, how on earth could you possibly know that? And they'll say, well, because Sagittariuses are this, and they're that, and they're that. And I listen to them, it's like they're describing me. It's amazing, right? So because there's real chachma there, and again, to what extent nowadays we have that chachma, I don't know, but there's definitely something real there, and the deeper svarim talk about it, and If it's in Sefer Yetzirah, which is a tribute to Avraham Avinu, certainly we could say that it goes back quite a long way. However, there are a number of sources in Chazal that tell us that the dili, the bucket, is actually the mazel of Klal Yisrael. It's the mazel of Klal, it's the sign under which Klal Yisrael is, so to speak, manifested. Now,
what could be combination in this or in
yeah, so it's not always connected with birth, right? But I mean,
but
by the tarot, what are the others? Right. So that's one of the reasons why we have to explain this. But we have to explain it even more, especially since the Gemara says that that Jewish people are not under any particular mazel, right? If they're not under any particular mazel, so how can we then say also they're not under any mazel? But the mazel that they're under is the mazel of the bucket. So we have to understand what that means. I don't know if we're going to have time to really get into an answer to that this week, but let's leave that on the table. Let's try to understand what is a dali, what is a bucket, what does it represent, and at least try to understand why we would say that it is the mazel of Klal Yisrael. So the Mnei Sasra says, we don't have it copied here, but he says in another mimer, he says that what is a dali? What is the function of a bucket? So if you think about it, a bucket is the quintessential eved. It's a vessel whose sole purpose is to take water in its classic use, right? To take water out of the well and into something else, right? It doesn't serve its own purpose. It's a medium. That's exactly the word. Its inherent function is to be a medium. That's what it is. That's why you could go into the grounds of... I once visited Windsor Castle. I forgot what it's called. Windsor Castle. Windsor Palace? I don't remember which one. Buckingham Palace, Windsor Castle, I think. I don't remember which one it is. Doesn't matter. In any case, I went to Windsor. And it was an absolutely stunning day. And... this was already quite a long time ago. It was over 20 years ago. And security was nowhere near as tight as it has subsequently become. Right? You all know that there was a story a number of years ago. I think they even made a film about it. A guy who was in... Yeah, exactly. Some guy who was in a bar drinking, and he made a drunken bet with his friends that he could go. He was going to go speak to the Queen. And he went, and he got into Buckingham Palace and climbed in through a window, ended up in the Queen's bedroom, and scared her almost to death until they came. And he was harmless. He didn't mean her any harm. He just wanted to talk to her. And so since that episode, security has been beefed up considerably, so I don't know if this could happen today. But for some reason, when I was in Windsor that day, I was there with a friend. I was 18 years old, and we decided we were going to leave the tour and go wandering around. And nobody stopped us. We wandered around the entire day, went into rooms, out of rooms, closed off rooms. There was, the velvet ropes that don't proceed beyond this point. We didn't listen. We paid no attention to any rules. Nobody stopped us the entire day. It was really fascinating. I mean, we weren't doing anything wrong. We weren't like opening up cabinets and poking around. But it was just, So one of the things that always struck me was that you have this castle. That's literally, I mean, I've never been to the White House, but I can't imagine that the White House could. I'm sure that there's it's awesome on some level, but not like this. I mean, this is like a real, medieval castle. I mean, this is like the furniture and the things that were in the cases, the jewelry and the knights, the armor. It was like all this opulence and wealth and so on and so forth. And then every time we would go into a room that was like a little behind the scenes, you'd see like all these like regular mundane tools lying around. There's like all the, this beautiful exhibit, and then the bell rope says don't go over here, and then you go in the back there and there's like, it's like a storage closet. There's like a mop and a bucket and a, it always struck me like the contrast, like, at the end of the day, they're people too. They got to have a mop and a bucket to clean the floor, And it's a regular mop and a bucket, just like I have in my house, Like, except maybe older, Like, not as good, But it always struck me. And Lemaisa, that's because why? Because even if you have a castle, even if you have all the money in the world, you're not going to get like a gold bucket with jewels on it. And a mop and an engraved mop handle to clean your floors, because it's just a medium. The point is not the mop and it's not the bucket. And even if you have all the money in the world, there's not, it's so much a medium that there's no point to decorating it whatsoever. And I'm sure, I mean, I you know, I didn't research this, but I'm sure if you go to any castle, any palace, residence of the world's leaders or the world's wealthiest people, you will find in a back closet somewhere a regular mop and a regular bucket that they clean the floors with, right? Because it's so much a medium that it's really nothing. It's just a medium. It has no other function. There's no aesthetic function. There's nothing else to it. So that's what a dali is. And the idea, therefore, of a dali is a complete bitul atzmi, a complete nullification of self. And you'll see already, if you're paying attention last week, if you're here last week we were talking about how Shemos, it was all about the development of self. Because, and I know the number of you who weren't here last week, so I'll just give like a 2-minute summation, if I can even do it in 2 minutes. But the idea was that we saw that Avraham Avinu back in Lech Lecha, Hashem told him he should go for yourself, and he went and actually took Hashem's advice literally, and he went and he was the protagonist who caused the brachos to come true. He, like Hashem told him, he's going to make him wealthy, so he went out to Mitzrayim. He told his wife, "I want you to say that you're my sister." Why? Yeah, it's true, they're going to kill me. But the first reason that he said was, "Say, Imrina Chosiat, say that you're my sister." Why? So it'll be good for me because of you. So it'll be good for me because of you. And then the next pasuk it says, "Ul Avram hated Bavura." It was very good for him because of her. Why? Because Paro gave him a lot of money, gifts, and livestock, and servants, and maids, and so on and so forth. Right. So Avram Avinu was taking advantage of the bracha, but not in a negative way, in the sense of trying to do the Hashem's will because he's going to benefit personally, but rather in the sense of building self. The building of self is what allows a person to give to others, right? That's what we saw the expression of that really in Moshe Rabbeinu, as we said, because Moshe Rabbeinu, we'll get into that even more as we get back towards Shemos, but Moshe Rabbeinu is the one who's a leader and who has to really develop a sense of self. He grows up in the palace of Paro and he comes out, and we said the beautiful pshat that it says he saw the Mitzri was attacking the Jews, so he looked around. But Yarki Enish, he saw there was nobody there. So we saw there was nobody there. So one of the pshatim that I heard, beautiful pshat, is that he saw that he wasn't yet a person because he had never taken sides in this. He was living in the palace, and his people were out being oppressed, and he had never had to actually like choose sides. Now he's the first time he's confronted with a choice of how he's going to act. So Vayarki Ein Ish, he sees that he's not yet an Ish. So he acts, he chooses, he kills the Mitzri, he takes the side of his family, of his brothers, of Klal Yisrael, and in so doing becomes an Ish. And I'm going to show you a little bit later on that that's actually true, that he mamish becomes an Ish at that point, or Ish Moshe, right? That's where he became the Ish. And therefore, it's about development of self, and it's only through development of self that one can hope to put self aside and act selflessly in a healthy way, right? Because to act selflessly when one has no self, and when one is just hiding from oneself, and one running around doing yudu chesed from today till tomorrow, is a very beautiful thing, and a lot of people will be helped, and it's wonderful. But if a person is not taking care of themselves, and hasn't developed themselves, and they're just doing chesed at the expense of themselves, their families, their wives, their community, whatever it is, and they're just, and so on. So they're, yeah, they're giving, they're doing all this chesed, but they don't have a self to give. Bitul atzmi, the whole term bitul atzmi, means nullification of self. If there's no self in the first place, then you can't be mevatel it, right? You have to have, so the idea of a medium is, it's not that there is no bucket. The bucket is there, right? The bucket is there, it's there and it has a function. But the bucket becomes a pure medium in that even though it has a self, its self does not have any need, in a sense, for expression other than its job as being a medium, right? It doesn't fall into the, right? Human beings are much more complicated, right? Because we think we have a self, and we want to develop ourselves, and then we can get very wrapped up in ourselves, and we can think a lot of ourselves, and we accomplish things, and so we think more of ourselves. Right. The idea of the bucket is to teach us, in a sense. Why is it the mazel of Klal Yisrael? It's because it's to teach us that our real goal is not to be a medium and therefore have no self. The real goal of Klal Yisrael is to have a self, but then to take that self and be mevatel it to the job of a medium. Because it's not valuable if you just become, if you're a medium and you never had a chance of doing anything else, you never really accomplished anything, you don't feel the, if a person like is born, it's even Moshe Rabbeinu, he's the Anav Mikol Adam, but he was the Anav Mikol Adam and he didn't get to his position by doing nothing, right? He argued with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we'll see, I don't know if we'll have time to go into it, but right, you have to know what you're capable of, but in order to know what you're capable of, you have to grow, you have to develop a sense of self. In order to use yourself to do the will of Hashem, in order to be mevatel yourself to the Ratzon Hashem, in order to nullify yourself in a sense to do the will of Hashem, you have to know what yourself is. If a person has tremendous kochos in teaching first graders, let's say, right? I happen to know somebody who's the most amazing first grade Rebbe, and unfortunately, he got into his head that that's not what he wants to be doing with his life, and he wants to be doing something else. Also in a good cause, but he's nowhere near as good at it. He's not as good at it. I could see it. But for some reason he has in his head that teaching first grade isn't as honorable, it's not as prestigious, it's not, you know, so he's acting in a way really that that's not like this. He's not being mavatel. The right thing is to say, oh, listen, in terms of prestige, it'd be much better not to be a first grade rabbi. But Lamaisa, look how good at it. Look how I'm able to accomplish. I have to be mevatel myself based on what I know about myself in order to do the Ratzon Hashem. So a deli, a bucket, is this pure medium that represents the idea of getting out of our own way, of having no other purpose other than being the medium. But it goes deeper than that, because what is a bucket used for? Essentially, a bucket is used for drawing water out of the well. So water, of course, is where the Gemara says, "Ein mayim ela Torah." Right? Water is Torah. So water is Torah. So the Gemara Sosra says like this. So we have to see ourselves, aside from in terms of Avodas Hashem, we have to see ourselves as the bucket to the water, meaning which is as the bucket to the Torah. Our purpose, we have to be the medium for Torah. Who was the first Eved in the Torah? Anyone know? Well, technically it was Avraham Avinu, because Avraham Avinu is referred to as Avraham Avdi. But that was, he was an Eved Hashem. So that, we're not going to count that because, but Eliezer was the first Eved in terms of like a slave to another human being. First Eved in the Torah, right? Now, Avraham Avdi, it makes a lot of sense according to what we're saying. Let's talk about Avraham for a minute. Why is he Hashem's Eved? Because what does Avraham do? Avraham could have done many things in the world, theoretically. He was clearly an extremely bright person, the only person of his generation, or of any of the generations beforehand, who was a deep enough and accurate enough philosopher to be able to comprehend the unity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to comprehend the idea that there was a first cause, as the Rambam describes it. So he had tremendous potential. In theory, he probably could have gone on to do many other things. But he, in a sense, he was mevatel himself, and he spent his life as a wanderer, right, who was clearly going against all of the rest of society. For what purpose? To bring the idea of Torah. What did he do? He taught Torah to the people. That's what he did. Like the Gemara tells us. So that's why the Tekufa of Torah begins with Avraham Avinu. If you divide the world into Tekufas, it's the first Tekufa, which is the Tekufa of like Tohu, and that lasts that's 2,000 years till Avraham Avinu, and then there's another 2,000 years of Torah, and then there's 2,000 years of Mashiach, which we are in. So, how does the Torah teach us really about what Avraham Avinu was as an Eved Hashem? By giving us a real living example of an Eved in this world. The Eved in this world, that's an example, is Eliezer, Eved Avraham. How is Eliezer introduced in the Torah? He's introduced as Damesek Eliezer. Very, very good. Damesek Eliezer. Do you know what the Gemara says in Yuma? The Gemara says in Yuma on Chach Ches Amid Beis. So the Gemara, close. That's very good. Very good. Bikis. So the Gemara says that Damesek is Dolek Lamashka. Dolek Lamashka. That he's like, literally, the English word dole comes from this, right? I would imagine, right? It's too similar to be a coincidence. To dole out. He's doling out the drink. He's doling out the water. Because the idea of Eliezer, in his essence, Damesek, well, it's a place. Dole Lamashka. Yeah. He's doling out, he's giving out the word. Why? Because Eliezer, who's the Eved Avram, what's he here for? He's just here to draw, in a sense, Torah from Avram Avinu and give it over. Eliezer was Avram Avinu's right hand man. He taught Torah as well. He taught the Torah that he learned from Avram Avinu. Yeah, the Mayim, in a sense, right? Which is Torah. So he's a Dali. He is a bucket, in a sense. Eliezer is a bucket. And that makes a lot of sense, right? Now, Rav Eitan Feiner, who was the one who, so to speak, turned me on to this B'nai Saskar, so he said that he had a chavrusa once who wanted to make an interesting suggestion. I'm not sure I would agree, but it's a little too complicated to go and argue with a former chavrusa of somebody that I just barely know. But he said that his chavrusa once suggested that maybe this is how we could get around the prohibition of teaching Torah to non-Jews, the prohibition to actively teach Torah to a non-Jew. There are different circumstances. I'm not talking necessarily halacha lamaisa. You have to know, if it comes down to halacha lamaisa, you have to ask a shayla. But the bottom line is, overall, you're not supposed to teach Torah to non-Jews. So how could Avraham Avinu go and teach Eliezer and so on? So he was suggesting, maybe since Eliezer was just a bucket, all he was a medium, and he himself wasn't, he had enough bitul atzmi that it wasn't like he was learning it for himself. So therefore, he was that's what I'm saying. It's not a great answer, but
teaching them just monotheism, not necessarily.
Yeah, it's a nice idea. The real answer is probably more that he wasn't actually teaching him Torah. But listen to this. So in Maseches Derech Eretz, Zuta, which is like one of the Maseches Derech Eretz. It's not in Shas. It's one of the outside Maseches that's kind of like somewhere in between Midrashim and Shas. It's like similar to what Brisos are to Mishnayos. You have certain Maseches that are like on the outside of the Gemara. So, there's a number of them. Right. So at the end of Perek Aleph there, I wanted to find this source and actually learn it inside, but I didn't get a chance. Maybe we'll still do it. The Gemara the text there lists, I don't know if you call it Gemara, Tisha shenichnasu b'chayeyan l'Gan Eden. Nine people who entered living into Gan Eden, meaning with their bodies into Gan Eden. And one of the people that's listed there as going in is Eliezer. And interestingly enough, I wanted to find to see who the other eight were. Right? I didn't get a chance to look it up. But it lists him as Eliezer Eved Avraham. So let's understand this. What is the reason, this comes from Rabbi Feiner, beautiful idea, what is the reason that a person's body does not go with them into Gan Eden? The answer to that is pretty obvious, because body is, but even a person who didn't do it, not necessarily are they the ones that are also listed as going to Gan Eden. I have to see the whole list. But the idea is that the body, but even more than, right, the body is, which is Gashmi, which is physical, right, is, which gives some sense of importance of reality to this existence. Some sense of something more than just being a medium.
I know that list. Different list from the four people who died.
It is different, correct. Right. So it's the body is the thing, it's the thing about a human being that gives us, or that really represents the capacity to feel like I have a self in this world, right? That I am something more than just a medium, right? Because I'm physically here, I have a physical presence. So therefore, to go into the world of the neshamos, the world of the true reality, the world of like Beishamah, where real reality is, so the body, which is the aspect of us that gives us the possibility of being confused and not really just being a medium, can't go along. But somebody who has been mevatel themselves completely, somebody who lived a life of complete bitul atzmi, where their physicality played no role in their sense of self and their identity, because they were an eved, they were defined as an eved, like Eliezer Eved Avraham, and Eliezer therefore is, it makes sense that he would be able to go in because he is complete bitul atzmi. It's like in a certain sense. Right, I was thinking that a model today would be here's a perfect model. I'm standing, I'm giving a shiur, right? So if I am thinking, anytime we do anything in the world, so we have to, there's like a whole process that we have to go through. So on one hand, I'm thinking, okay, I prepared a certain number of hours for the shiur, and I saw a certain number of sources, and I came up with certain ideas of my own, and certain ideas that I took from other people, and so on, right? So if I'm standing here, I'm giving the shiur, and let's say that I feel that it's going well, so often, it makes sense, right? I feel good, oh, the shiur's going well, people are listening, people are people are getting it. I can tell that they're getting it, right? So that's something that I have to be very careful about, because really, in essence, what we're saying here is that I'm really no different than this, right? I'm a little bit more sophisticated, right? But really what I am is a very sophisticated MP3 player, right? Because what does an MP3 player do? An MP3 player, right? The Chafetz Chaim says that in the modern world, a person should look at technology and from technology, learn things about spirituality. Right, so here's an example where you can do that. Because what is an MP3 player? MP3 player, well, could be used for many things, but the thing that I use it for most and I'm most excited about is Shiurim, right? I can take an MP3 player, I can listen to Shiurim and so on. And now, of course, a human being can give over a Shiur. There's more expressions that are involved. There's the facial expressions, the hand expressions, whatever it is. The communication, when it's directly from one human being to another, is much more powerful than an MP3 player. But essentially, to give the Shiur on the highest level would require me being mevatel myself and see myself 100% as just a medium that was like a bucket that dipped into the water of the Torah earlier this week and scooped up some of that water and is now giving over the water to other people. Right? That would be the right way to look at it. That's why, says the Bnei Yisrael, when Eliezer is looking for a wife for Yitzchak, right? So the Pasuk says that Eliezer says, how is he going to know if the right one comes along? So he comes up with a great test. He's going to wait until someone comes along who says that she wants to give the right, ha'alti na eskadeh, give me your kad, give me your pitcher, which is the same as a bucket, right? And I'm going to give you water. I'm going to give the gemalim water. Right? What's the pshat in water? Why is that? Because Eliezer understands. He knows that he's a dali. He knows he's a bucket. He understands that he's mevatel himself. So he's looking for an appropriate shidduch for Yitzchak. So the test that he devises is one that will immediately give him a sign that this is a person who understands being a medium. If the first thing that she says is, oh, let me take care of your needs, let me draw from the well, it's not just the pshat that she's randomly saying that it's like nice, unless it's orchim. It's that she's basically saying, like, I know what it means to be a dali. I know what it means to be a medium. And Eliezer, therefore, is the perfect person to send on a mission because he's going to be able to complete the mission without himself getting involved. And we know that his self was like pushing a little bit, trying to get involved because he had a daughter that he would have liked Yitzchak to marry, and he had to work on himself to not let that come out. But he also was the perfect one to recognize the perfect shidduch for Yitzchak through this thing. And it gets even better. We're going to start bringing this together for part one. Now, it gets even better like this. Because when Yisro's daughters go out, right, Moshe, we said, becomes an ish by making that decision to kill the Mitzri. So then he comes to the daughters of Yisro, and there, where are they? Again, they're by a well, right? This is no accident. They're by a well, and they're trying to get water, and the other shepherds are antagonistic towards them, right? And Moshe basically takes care of them. Moshe saves them. So they come back in. They come to the house, and they tell Yisro that they were saved by this Dalo Dala Lanu Ish, right? What is it? Something like Ish Mitzri Hitzi Lanu. There was a Ish Mitzri who saved us, right? And how? Dalo Dala Lanu Vayashkes Atzon. Right, he was dala. He was dali. Right, he doled out the water to us and to our livestock. So now Yisro is not just a regular average person, right? We know that he was a searcher of truth. He had searched through the Men of Chelsea, had searched through all the different religions and all the different avodah zarahs. He's also an incredibly wise man because he was one of Paro's advisors. In order to be one of Paro's advisors means that he had to know all sorts of kishuf, all sorts of magic, and all sorts of very deep ideas and deep things, right? Because even the kindergartners in Paro's court knew how to turn sticks into snakes, right? As we saw last week. So clearly Yisro, who was an top advisor of the Paro, had to be very, very highly advanced person for his time. So Yisro hears, Dalo Dala Lanu. So Yisro says to them, bring him in. And when he says to bring him in, so Yisro says, bring in the Ish. He doesn't say Ish Mitzri. Right? You look at the Pesukim, you'll see. He doesn't say Ish Mitzri, he says Ish. Why? Because he understands that it can't be an Ish Mitzri. Ish Mitzri, what the word Mitzri means, constricted, a place of constriction, right? A person who's constricted, who's in a place where they're not complete, they're not whole, they can't No, they can't do bitul atzmi. Bitul atzmi, right, nullification of self, to be like a dali, to be like a bucket, requires a healthy, wholesome person who has a self, an atzmi, to be mevatel. Right, a mitzri is a pshat, somebody who doesn't have a self because they're constricted. They have they're in a narrow place. They're not able to be expansive. They're not able to develop into their full potential. They're constricted. So he knows immediately he can't be an ish mitzri. So he says to bring him because he understands from the dalo dala. He gave you water with a bucket. That's telling me something that's much deeper, such as that he was a nice guy that he helped you out. It's not an ish mitzri. That's an ish. That's an ish. And that's the Moshe who was running to Yisro from becoming the ish. Yisro recognizes that in him. Until that, see, to be a dola, you have to have an atzmi to be mevatel. Until Moshe Rabbeinu left the palace and made that decision to stand with his brothers and kill the ish mitzri, until he made that decision, he wasn't an ish. He didn't have the possibility of being mevatel himself, right? It's only after he became an ish, and he goes to Yisro, and he's recognized as such, then he can grow further and into becoming the Moshe that, and of course Moshe becomes, of course, the Eved Hashem, who we've talked about many times, becomes like the Meshech Chachma. It's only one opinion, but a very powerful opinion nonetheless. How the Meshech Chachma says in the introduction to Sefer Shmos, that Moshe Rabbeinu became a person who had no Bechira. He eventually became so highly developed that he lost his Bechira. He lost his ability to make choices. Why? Because because he became such a medium for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that he knows, does a bucket make a decision? A bucket doesn't make a decision. The decision is made by the person who's using the bucket, right? So Moshe becomes the quintessential Dali in a sense, and of course Moshe himself is a Dali. Is Moshe not someone who is put into the water and drawn out of the water? His whole name comes, like we talked last week, from Kimina Mayim Mishisiu, because he was drawn from the water. Why is Moshe called Moshe? The Mepharshim ask, that Moshe, if you think about it, he should have been called past tense, that he was Mashui, right, that he was Mashui from the water. Why is it called Moshe, active present tense? Because that defines who he is. It's not just that he was taken out of the water.
Like it was being done to him.
Mishahu. Yeah, it was done to him. He was the one who was taken from the water.
He's doing
right. That's the question.
It has nothing to do with past. It has more to do with
he's right. Active, passive, or right. No, Mashui means he was the one that was taken from Moshe. He is doing it. Right. So the answer is this fits in perfectly, because if Moshe is the quintessential Eved Hashem, and therefore he's like a bucket, he is just a medium, so he is the Moshe. What does he do? He draws the water from the water of which is the Torah, from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he gives it over to Klal Yisrael. That is his function, without any free will whatsoever, because the free will has been transcended by the fact that he has been Mevatel himself. And of course,
right. Because there was no aspect of himself.
Right.
So the Dali is only the medium. So what analogy would you use to a Navi where his character puts a stamp?
We're going to talk about that, I think, a little bit more next week. That's a very important point. It goes into the whole concept of Navi here is very, very cogent, because here is where he becomes a Navi, and here's where HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a sense, defines Navi. For example, you'll notice in the Psukim, I think in last week's Parsha, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls Aaron HaKohen Moshe's Navi. You have to, like, he flashes by every year. You don't notice these things, right? But it's really, and Moshe is the Elohim to Aaron. Insane Psukim that, like, you don't understand how people can just, you're listening to the Torah, and how could somebody not just, like, jump out of their seats in the middle of laning, myself included, you know, like, what? You know, but that's what it says. You can check it out.
It's in, so, Navi as a Navi Hashem.
Right.
In this case, wasn't Navi Hashem, but so, in this case, it was a Navi.
Right. So we have to talk about it. Right. So we have to talk about it.
Navi doesn't mean Navi by itself, you say.
But that requires
Navi Hashem means somebody.
Well, that's right. So we have to see. I'm giving the Rashi Prakim, but obviously it needs a lot of development to figure out exactly what it means. But you're on the right track. So in any case, let's just finish this up. So who's Chet comes about through water? Moshe Rabbeinu's chet comes about through water. So now it makes a lot of sense. Moshe Rabbeinu is Moshe Eved Hashem, who is a Dali in the sense that he's just a pure medium. He doesn't have his own self because he had such a self and was able to be Mevatelet. Now he goes and somehow, and this, of course, we've asked this question a million times every time I talk about Moshe not having his Bechira and then his Bechira taken away because he had transcended it. So everybody always says, well, how can he do a chet? Right?
Do a chet.
he certainly didn't listen to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, somebody who doesn't have the ability to make a decision, right, who is a pure medium. So the question is, so how does that work? So, without going into it too much at depth, but to be able to say that basically Moshe's koach, in a sense, is his, and this is where we connect with last week. So last week we said that Moshe, because he comes from the water represents the hidden world. Everything that's under the water is hidden. We can't see it. We can't interact with it. In science, we don't know anything about what's under the ocean. And on land, we know a lot more. So the idea of, and we said that the Baal HaTanya says that Kriyas Yamsuf, the idea was that Hashem splits the sea, splits the water, so that he reveals that which is underneath the water, which is usually hidden, it's really the same. He's letting us know it's all the same. It's all HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's all the same. So Moshe, in a sense, is the one who really should be getting this at the highest level. He's like a bucket, literally. I mean, it goes even stronger than that. What does a bucket do when it goes into the water? The bucket splits the water, right? And then when it comes out, the water goes right back. What does that have Moshe Rabbeinu do with Kal Yisrael? He comes to the water. Okay, not sure Benjamin Nadav was would help him, but he splits the water. They go through, and then the water closes right behind them. Right? Right, and I said Moshe, and leading Am Yisrael, it becomes the bucket. That's the idea of being the medium. And when they were crossing the sea, they saw the highest Nebuah. What's the pshat? They saw the highest Nebuah. They understood that the ultimate relate. They understood HaKadosh Baruch Hu so clearly that they understood that their role was to be exactly that, just to be mediums. And so therefore, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's bringing water from the rock, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells him to speak to it, and not to hit it, so there's something that goes wrong over there, because he uses a physical action as opposed to speech. There's a whole other Torah that if you'll bear with me for another 5 minutes, I can try to. I've mentioned it before. We've spoken about it before, but the Rashi says, when Rashi talks about the hitting of the rock, so Rashi says a kal v'chomer. A kal v'chomer is a line of reasoning in the Gemara and in Chazal that I think it's called like a priori reasoning, technically, in technical philosophical jargon. But how much more so? Right. If you have something simple that has a certain attribute, how much more so something that's even more complicated should have that basic attribute? Or it could work the other way. It gets a little complicated. But Rashi says a kal v'chomer that doesn't seem to make any sense. He says the reason why Moshe was punished for hitting the rock is because Moshe Rabbeinu said, Hashem says to Moshe, you had an opportunity to teach Klal Yisrael something. You could have taught Klal Yisrael that just like the rock which can't think for itself, and you tell it what Hashem says to do and it listens to Hashem, so you who can't think for yourself certainly should listen to Hashem. So you read that kal v'chomer, you say, what is going on? It'd be like, I always give the example that, like, let's say I tell my kid, you have to go, it's time to go to sleep. He says, I don't want to go to sleep. So I say, listen, we have a computer. Just like the computer, which doesn't think for itself, and I push the button to make it go to sleep, it goes right to sleep. So you think for yourself, you certainly should go right to sleep when I tell you to go to sleep. My kid's like, what are you talking about? I'm not a computer, right? That's exactly why I'm not listening to you, because I don't have a button that you can push. Right? So I understand, what is Rashi trying to think? That's what Rashi says. Hashem said, you could have taught Kali Sol Kal Bachomer. Kal Bachomer would have been, just like the rock, which can't think for itself, would have listened. You certainly should listen. But now we have all this whole backdrop, so we can see that in a sense, the chet of Moshe Rabbeinu was not so much in the fact that he hit the rock and didn't speak to the rock, but more that the opportunity was here to clearly reinforce this idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be mediums. That if a rock, the idea is that just like a rock which doesn't have a decision-making process, but it brings forth the water from Hashem, so what is the pshat? The rock is a bucket. That's all the rock is. If Hashem says to the rock, be a bucket, the rock will be a bucket, because the rock is a bucket. There's no difference. A rock is a medium. It's here for the purpose of whatever it is that Hashem wants it to do here, but it doesn't have its own thought, and it doesn't have its own ability to make decisions, and so on and so forth. It has a complete bitul atzmi, right? A rock doesn't have feelings and gaiva and the ability to think it, that it's important and so on, right? So therefore, Moshe speaks to the rock, and the rock gives forth water, so you had an opportunity to teach Klai Yisrael that's how we're supposed to be. That's what we're supposed to aspire to. We're supposed to aspire to a level where we're so much mevatel to Avodas Hashem, to connecting to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that we'll do naturally, without having to, right, we'll get to the level of what you, Moshe Rabbeinu, are on, that level of just of allowing, in a sense, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's water, the Mayim of Torah, to flow through us, just being a bucket that goes into the water and out of the water, and into the water and out of the water, and that's the goal, a tremendous opportunity to teach that that lesson. And this ties in very much, and maybe we'll pick up with this idea next week because it'll be a good way to connect. This ties in very much with the idea in Yeshayahu. There's a pasuk in Yeshayahu that talks about the idea of water, the cycle of water coming down. The water comes down from Shemayim and it waters the earth, and it has a certain purpose to achieve, and it doesn't return to the Shemayim until it achieves that purpose. And as it goes into the ground, it goes into the seed of, let's say, of the tree, and it energizes that seed and so on, and then eventually it'll come back out through the tree in a fruit or whatever. Eventually it ends up back. But the pshat and in the nevuah in Yeshayahu says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, that I am just like that water. Just like the water comes down from Shemayim, it comes down to Aretz. And it has a job to do, and it doesn't come back up until the job is done. So too, my words, when I speak, in a sense, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives orders, so to speak, when he gives mitzvahs, when he gives Torah, when he tells us something, so that has a job to do here, and it doesn't come back up until it does that job. Right, so the idea is that the deeper idea is that that's what we're supposed to be, because after all, the deeper message is it's going to happen anyway. We are going to be buckets whether we like it or not. Right, we can live our entire lives thinking that we're one thing, right? Thinking that we're this, that we're that, that we're this, whatever it is, whatever we construct in our own minds. Ultimately, we are just mediums. Now, we are mediums that were given the possibility of pretending that we're not mediums, right? So we can live a life of pretense, or we can live a life of reality. The life of reality means that we have to recognize ourselves, and it's an avoda of a lifetime. It doesn't happen overnight, right? It's an avoda of bitul atzmi. It doesn't happen overnight, and a person has to do it in a healthy way. It can only come after there's a strong, healthy self built up, because if a person doesn't build up their own self first in a healthy way, and then they try to be mevatel themselves, they're not really being mevatel anything. They're just damaging themselves. They have no possibility of knowing if they're doing the right thing or not. There's no apparatus, right? It's like an MP3 player, right? If an MP3 player, before it's fully built and has batteries in it and is completely primed to do its job, you try to put it into service, right? So you can push play and record from today till tomorrow. It's never going to do what it's supposed to do. It has no chance of doing what it's supposed to do because it doesn't have a self yet. It doesn't have any. It's not fully constructed yet. It's only a fully constructed self that one can be mevatel, right? So obviously that's a process because we're always growing. But as we're growing, like the more healthy we become, the more we become comfortable with ourselves, and we grow into ourselves, the more we can then see opportunities for taking ourselves and being mevatel ourselves in the service of Avodas Hashem and connecting Kadosh Baruch Hu, so that the bracha, the water, the Torah that Kadosh Baruch Hu gives down can accomplish its purpose through us. We can accomplish our appropriate purpose. The appropriate buttons can be pushed, and what's supposed to happen will happen. And the better we are at doing that, the quicker we'll be able to complete, so to speak, our avoda and really be the complete non-selves that we're supposed to grow into and connecting to Kadosh Baruch Hu. Next week, we'll pick up with this idea of hitting the rock, and we'll try to develop it and continue and tie it into the Parshios directly.